Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, and our friends in the public media spectrum across the region, bringing you the latest news of the day. I'm Carl Lengel, your host. It is Friday, the 12th of June, 2026. The 1972 Montana Constitution opened up state government, requiring open meetings, roll call votes, and public participation. YPR's Kay Erickson reports people can hear firsthand on how legislating in Montana changed under the new Constitution at a program Monday night in Billings.
Dorothy Bradley, Bob Brown, and Tom Tao served in the Montana legislature before and after the 1972 Constitution. They'll be speaking at Before and After Times, sponsored by the Friends of the Montana Constitution, a group focused on the legacy of the document and the 1972 Constitutional Convention. Friends spokesperson Susan Byorth-Fox says the Billings event is an effort to advance our civic education and understanding of the 1972 Constitution.
And so I think they will help point out some of the unique aspects of our Constitution and how it has really affected our current situation in politics.
The public presentation, The Before and After Times, is Monday night, June 15th, from 5:30 to 7:30 at Petro Theater on the MSU Billings campus. For more information on the Friends of the Montana Constitution, you can go to their website, montanaconstitution.org. In Billings, I'm Kay Erickson.
The body of an adult male was recovered from Yellowstone Lake in Yellowstone National Park earlier this week. A Park News release reports occupants of a vessel on Yellowstone Lake discovered the body of Brandon Ray of Denver on June 8th, floating in the water near Bridge Bay on the northwest shore of the lake. Park rangers responded to the lake and recovered the body along with a capsized kayak and personal belongings. Park officials report the incident is under investigation. Wyoming is having trouble supporting the well-being of its children in key areas, according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation's latest report on child wellness. Eric Galatas with the Wyoming News Service has more.
The 2026 Kids Count data book details how child well-being declined between 2019 and 2024, driven largely by poor educational outcomes and rising housing costs. Leslie Bossier is the foundation's vice president of external affairs. She says this year's report demonstrates that when policymakers prioritize investments in children, kids do well.
It is intended to shine a spotlight on the well-being of children and also to pinpoint investments that are making a difference, to show policymakers where they are doing well and where there needs to be greater investment so that kids can thrive.
Wyoming ranks third in children's economic well-being, but economic prosperity isn't reaching all Wyoming kids. Approximately 12,000 children still live in poverty. One in four kids are living in families that have to pay 30% or more of their income to remain housed. However, the state did see an increase in the number of kids living in families where the head of the household has a high school diploma. Wyoming ranks 12th overall for child well-being. I'm Eric Galatas.
The Beartooth Highway, U.S. Highway 212, that links Red Lodge to the northeast entrance to Yellowstone National Park, has reopened to traffic as of Thursday afternoon, according to the road's supervisor with Yellowstone National Park. A Facebook post from the Wyoming Transportation Department says the pass received 3 to 5 inches of snow Tuesday night, and the situation worsened with high winds, drifts, and near zero visibility. Several vehicles, including their occupants, were stuck on Beartooth Pass due to the snowstorm. Once the motorists were rescued, road crews with the park began clearing the Wyoming side of the pass. Even with the Beartooth Pass open for the season, storms can close down the highway. For up-to-date road conditions from Montana and Wyoming Transportation, go to 511mt.net or map.wyoroad.info. A church, a nonprofit, and a barbershop are suing the Laramie County Sheriff's Office over its 287 agreements with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. This marks the first legal challenge to these contracts in Wyoming. The ACLU represents the plaintiffs and claims the sheriff broke state law by signing agreements without public input. They also allege violations of the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act. The lawsuit seeks to void the agreements, which allow local law enforcement to perform immigration enforcement. The ACLU is also investigating other Wyoming agencies with similar contracts, potentially leading to more legal actions. Laramie Sheriff Brian Kozak declined to comment. Billings Alive After Five kicked off Thursday evening. On an outdoor stage next to the pub station, the opening act Holland Dotson and Cole Jonathan greeted a crowd of a couple of hundred adults and children enjoying the warm weather and festivities. Becky Harvey was a first-time attendee.
My brother's lived here for 6 years, and we finally just made the trek from southeast South Dakota. And my brother works for the pub station serving hot dogs, and so we came to kind of check it out and see him working and listen to live music with our kiddos. We're always a big fan of live music and being out in the sunshine, the beautiful weather. It's gorgeous.
The seasonal event is sponsored by the Downtown Billings Alliance. It features 8 Thursday evening appearances across the eastern side of downtown. James is one of the DBA employees helping to keep the street crossings on Montana Avenue safe.
We're at rush hour. It's 5:35 right now, but for the most part, people are being pretty good. You know, we've got our new crossing lights.
Alive After Five is not just an outdoor family street party, but a reminder that Billings might be growing to its outer limits, but it still has an historic downtown that is thriving with businesses. Ryan works at Bar MT, which is located just across Montana Avenue in the old train depot.
We really do feel an impact if it is within about a block or 3 blocks.
Alive After Five continues across numerous locations Thursday evenings through July 30th. Over 100 years ago, the Fort Shaw Indian girls basketball team made history playing games across the state and becoming world champions in 1904. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Traxler reports on the celebration honoring the players and their descendants.
It's a crisp morning in Fort Benton, a small town nestled on the banks of the Missouri River. The smell of burning sage trickles into the fresh summer air as people begin arriving. Michelle Hernandez begins the celebration with a blessing and introduction.
I am from Fort Hall, Idaho, and I'm here representing my great-grandmother, Minnie Burton. Shoot, Minnie, shoot!
Hernandez and nearly 100 visitors, descendants, and locals are sitting in white chairs facing a new mural commissioned by Destination Fort Benton to honor the team. Fort Shaw Indian girls basketball team navigated boarding school and forced assimilation while becoming a team of skilled athletes and artists. They played games throughout the state before eventually debuting at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904. Among the event's speakers is Linda Peavy, who co-authored a book on the history of the team. It took over a decade.
So that's sort of how this story happened, and it keeps having a life of its own.
She says the spirit of the story lives on in part through preservation. Attendees filter up to the second floor of the Fort Benton Pharmacy. Wood floors creak under the visitors. Old Masonic designs stretch along red faded walls. Here, the girls played a game exactly 123 years ago to the day. The day wrapped up in the town's agricultural museum. Here stood a backdrop of belongings, photos, and historical records about the team, including a buckskin dress made by one of the players. Outside, Sanchez looks at a large photo of her great-grandmother, Minnie.
What an honor to bless this place. You know, it was like, brought tears to my eyes thinking my grandmother played here.
She says the legacy lives on through days like this. Reporting from Fort Benton, I'm Victoria Traxler.
The popular Rocky Mountain Jazz Collective plays Motown this weekend. Clark Sturgis and the Rocky Mountain Jazz Collective promise a wild ride through the Detroit music scene in the 60s. Motown hits and vibrant jazz renditions will celebrate the rhythm and soul of this legendary genre Saturday, June 13th, at Q State and Performing Arts Center in Lockwood. Motown is a record label and a genre that blends R&B, soul, and pop. It's known for its distinctive sound and strong influence on American music. The Motown label produced a record number of chart-topping artists, including Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the Temptations, Diana Ross and the Supremes, the Jackson 5, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and countless others. At this concert, the Rocky Mountain Jazz Collective will play a wide variety of Motown songs expertly arranged by music director Scott Jappesen.
So, you know, there's a lot of things digitally and combinations of instruments and things like that that they did with layering of sounds in Motown that it gives us some opportunity to explore some of that as well. So if you look at anything in the history of, you know, R&B music, any of that is kind of fair game in what you might end up seeing on the 13th.
Rocky Mountain Jazz Collective plays Motown is scheduled for Saturday, June 13th at Q State Performing Arts Center, previously known as Lockwood Performing Arts Center. The concert begins at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6. For more information, visit billingsymphony.org. That's The Worm for this Friday. Catch up with us tomorrow. We'll have another episode of The Weekend Worm for you, early birds.
The Worm is a production of Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal art call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.